You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9am to 12 midday.
It's Morning Focus here with you until 12 o'clock. Some live music in studio in an hour's time. But right now, your questions answered by Dr. Maura Finn of the Ennis Family Medical Centre. Dr. Finn, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And thank you very much for joining us this morning. We're just, as I said to our listeners this morning, answering questions. So we'll get cracking on some of those that have already reached us this morning. And a listener who has a 3.5-year-old, it's not my own, has been in touch. This child, I don't know if it's a boy or a girl, has a really bad cough and has had it for the past 3 months. Their doctor has said it is a nasal drip. And our listener is wondering what would cause a nasal drip for so long. It's night and day now. He has it really bad.
Yeah, it's a bit miserable. Very often a cough is a post-nasal drip. It's when, you know, you've got congestion in your nose. It either comes down the front and you blow it out through your nostrils, or it drips down the back and it causes a constant irritation and a cough as a result. So it would be particularly bad at night if it's a post-nasal drip, because when you lie down, it drips down the back more often. If it is like a three-month congestion like that, it may be an allergy. It may be a thing called perennial rhinitis, which is quite unusual in a small child. Usually it's kind of a viral thing, but it could be one thing after another after another. Like at that age, they get exposed to multiple viruses, and the child might be actually improving for a day or two and then getting something else. So that could be what's happening. Could be.
So it's just a bad run of it.
It could be a bad run of it. It could be, like I say, a perennial rhinitis or a kind of an allergy type based thing, which are usually environmental allergies now, not food allergies, but kind of air based allergies. So it could be something like that. And you might like to try an antihistamine, or there's a treatment called Singulair, which is a treatment that we use for asthma as well, but it's actually to dry up that kind of congestion in the nose area. But primarily what I would do, and I say this all the time, I know you laugh at me, but I'd have that child in the bath every night so that you're decongesting him as much as you can. You're clearing out as much crap out of his nose as you possibly can, so that he or she would probably sleep reasonably well for the first bit of the night anyway. And just because children don't blow their noses properly, they really find it difficult to do it. So if you can kind of decongest them, use a bit of Vicks, use a little bit of Albus oil or something, it'll make them more comfortable. And see, if they're not unwell, it isn't anything to be too concerned about.
Even after 3 months?
Well, if it's only coming from a tickly cough in the throat and definitely coming from the nose, it's not really anything to be concerned about if they're not unwell. If it was a cough that was coming from the chest, from the lungs after 3 months, yes, absolutely, you'd follow up on it. And I suppose it's difficult for a parent to be aware, be sure of which way it is.
Yeah, because in an adult, a chesty cough has got that big, deep back, but a young child can't. Yeah. They don't have the vocal cords to do
that. If the chest has been listened to and they say that it's completely clear, that's fine. But I mean, after 3 months, it would be reasonable to go back and check it again and maybe look for some sort of treatments that you might try just to see if they make a difference.
And I was just going to say, on those treatments, you mentioned the antihistamines and Singulair. I presume that would be because of a child of this age in conjunction with your doctor.
Yeah, you can buy antihistamines over the counter. Something like Zyrtec is available over the counter, and you could try that. But again, you'd want to do the decongesting too. But the Singulair certainly is by prescription, and it would be something you'd discuss at length with your doctor first.
I've got a couple of questions in on asthma. First of all, can adults contract asthma? And if so, how do you test for it?
They can actually, but it's much more common that it presents in the early years. It actually very commonly presents as a child and can sometimes improve a lot, and then it may actually re-emerge as an adult. But it can, for its first presentation, start as an adult. But it's difficult to differentiate between what's called COPD then, which is chronic obstructive airways disease, which is similar to asthma, but it's not reversible the way asthma is. But the symptoms are very similar in that you have a wheeze or a cough or recurring chest infections. Usually with COPD, the big trigger for it is smoking. Asthma tends to be something that can be related to smoking, unfortunately, but it can very often be induced by a reaction to something or exercise, or you know, something brings on an attack of asthma or a tightness in the airways. But yes, it can come on as an adult. And if somebody's concerned that they're developing asthma, they really need to go and be properly assessed, because no matter what, they are actually having difficulty with their breathing, difficulty with the respiratory system. And
so
as an adult,
even if it's not asthma,
either way, you need to be checked out and see. Okay. And the diagnosis can sometimes be a bit fluid. It might be difficult to be absolutely certain which condition it is. We do spirometry tests to see about lung function and reversibility. But the treatments are very similar anyway. So usually would involve inhaler treatments. And anyway, it's really important that you actually have some sort of chronic lung disease, you have your flu vaccine, and that you're given all sorts of proper advice around that as an adult, be it asthma or COPD.
You mentioned inhalers and treatment for asthma. Actually, that's the second question. Somebody's asking, besides inhalers, are there other treatments? You probably mentioned antihistamines being the main one.
Antihistamines, it can be. If somebody has a particularly kind of like that nasally part of asthma, antihistamines and singulair, again, it's a kind of a version, it's a modification of an antihistamine, really. It's a mast cell stabilizer, can be very good treatment for it. But actually, the most important treatments for anything like that are avoiding your triggers, make sure you don't smoke, you're not in an environment of smoke, try and take your flu vaccine, make sure you protect yourself against any kind of illness that is going to cause an exacerbation of your illness, and managing yourself really well, be that with inhalers or increasing your exercise capacity and stuff. So the inhalers are one part of it, but only one part of it.
Okay. Moving on to other matters then. Liam has been in touch. He says he's in his 40s and he's always tired. Why is this? What can he do to change it?
Oh God, that is such a common complaint. Being tired all the time is actually like such a common presentation in a doctor's surgery. And very often, what we tend to do is do a full kind of workup on somebody. You do a full examination, you take a history, you see is there anything that can be kind of alarming or might suggest that there is something kind of in particular wrong.
Sure.
And you do blood tests and you look for anemia and thyroid dysfunction and all sorts of different things like that. But very frequently, we don't find a cause. And very frequently, it settles of its own accord. Be it something like that, it has been a virus that they had and they've been very slow to recover from it, or it's very often just a lifestyle issue that, you know, they're not sleeping well. And as a result, they're constantly kind of on a catch up. Too stressed in their work environment or their home environment. There's something else happening that's underlying. It can be a kind of a sign of a mood disorder. So there can be multiple different reasons behind it. It is, there is not one answer here, and it's something that you actually maybe work out over time with somebody. What could the problems be? One thing I would say that always helps is doing a little bit more exercise. The more exercise you do, the more energy you have. It's a difficult thing to start, because when you're wrecked, the last thing you want to do is go out and exercise.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's very difficult to try to start it, but if you do, it does actually kind of make you have more exercise, more energy, and you tend to want to exercise more as well then, because you get that endorphins from the exercise too. But the basic investigations should be done too. If it's going on for more than 3 months, I certainly would investigate it.
How often is your, you know, when it isn't something serious, how often is your advice to patients also make sure you're getting a bit more sleep?
Oh yeah, I mean, and it's not actually, it's about getting proper sleep as well. It's not just kind of get to bed. It's kind of go to bed, turn off the screens, go to sleep, you know. Be tired, be physically tired, so that when you go to bed, you actually sleep, as opposed to being exhausted from an emotional and psychological point of view. So that bit of exercise helps you sleep better too. So yeah, very often it is actually look at your lifestyle. What are you doing wrong? Are you commuting to work? Are you wrecked? But then are you getting home too late because you're on night shifts or late shifts and you can't shut down. It does all these things, you know, that have, it's our modern life, unfortunately.
Hard to fix some of them.
It's very hard to fix some of them. But that's where you need to look. I mean, I suppose life is short. You need to live it and live it properly. And if you're constantly working on an empty, it's a very difficult way to be. And it's not good for anybody around you either, you know.
Okay. Speaking of sleep, what can my husband take or do to stop snoring? Asks what I imagine is a very frustrated wife.
Probably. It's not a very simple thing. Often, okay, the big reasons for it would be something like nasal congestion, like we were talking about the child earlier. That'll make you snore. Lying on your back, you tend to snore more because you're just, your mouth opens more. If you have polyps in your nose, if you have some problem with your nose, that will actually kind of encourage it. There's sleep apnea, which is where you kind of have this condition where you just, your throat collapses slightly and you actually make more noises, but you tend to sleep and wake and sleep and wake, and very disturbed sleep for everybody involved, so for her and for him. So really the cause is probably the most important thing there. What's causing this? Is there nothing really underlying? It's just a habit of snoring. There's very little you can do about that. There are these things to help you kind of open your nasal passages a little bit more, making sure you're decongested going to bed, separate beds.
pillow over the face.
Oh. You said that.
That's a joke. That is a joke, just to be clear. But that's kind of what you're looking at.
Yeah, it's difficult. It really is. And it's one of, you know, when we were talking about the old cures for things like, there must be a million cures for snoring because none of them work.
Exactly. So. A million, but none at the same time. Try and get yourself to sleep earlier.
Yeah.
If you can get a sleep, you know, I don't know if that's possible.
And alcohol, actually, you tend to snore if you're kind of had a few, if he's had a few pints and he's, he'd probably tend to snore more too. So that's something you could look at as well.
One more for now. Are there any vitamins or supplements that can be taken to help me with my vision? That comes from Sarah.
Well, that's a good question, actually, because there are you remember from when you were kids,
carrots.
It's all about carrots.
Yeah,
but it is actually beta carotene in carrots and things like, you know, peppers and sweet potato and stuff. But carrots are the Irish kind of version of this.
Sure.
Are full of vitamins that are really, really good for your eyes. And vitamin A in general is very good for your vision. So there's actually lots of supplements out there that are designed for vision. And some of the eye specialists would recommend them for people. And they can help your cornea stay clear. You know, they kind of reduce your risks of cataracts and things like that. So some people would suggest that once you get to a certain age, you should take a supplement. I actually believe I have some at home, but I've forgotten to take them. And then looking after your eye health as well. Go and have it checked, because you will have, people will sometimes be developing small issues in their eyes and not be aware of them because we compensate. We don't really realise, you know. So you'd have people, you know, who'd have a cataract and they wouldn't actually even know they had one. And that's where you have a cloudy bit in your lens and you actually can't see through it, you know. So so get your eyes checked fairly frequently, and vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin B, vitamins, and carrots.
And there are some specialists.
There's special ones, yeah. There's MacuShield and lutein and all these things. But the pharmacy will be great for telling you about those.
I know why you're recommending eye tests, and you are right. I'll tell you a quick story before we go to a break.
Okay.
I had my, for the first time since I was a child, I got my eyes tested last year. I was told that I was squinting a little bit more, and went along, got the test, touch wood, thankfully everything was fine, and I was just told I was getting old. Yeah.
They were wrong, of course.
Don't think they were. Back with more in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9 a.m. to 12 midday.
Keep your questions going for Dr. Maura Finn. She's still with us here in studio, 086 1800 964 for your texts. I've been asked about strokes, Dr. Finn, and somebody is wondering, is there a genetic contributory factor towards them?
Okay, well, there's multiple contributory factors towards strokes. So, like, strokes and heart disease really are the end point of a lot of things that we would be telling you to avoid, you know, so having high blood pressure, avoiding smoking, making sure you're exercising well, make sure you're not obese, make sure that your diet is good and you're not developing diabetes. All of those things individually are big risk factors for stroke and heart disease. So some of those things have genetic factors in them. So you may be more inclined to develop diabetes if you have a family history of it. You may be more inclined to high blood pressure if you have a family history of it. But most of them are actually things you can do things about yourself. So there are factors that are genetic, but really what you should, if you have a family history of stroke, that's not unusual. And what you need to do is make sure that you improve all your own individual risk factors. So you don't smoke, you alcohol to a minimum, you keep your weight at a good level, you stay active and fit, you have a low fat, low salt, low sugar diet. Those three things: low fat so you don't become obese, low sugar so you hopefully don't develop diabetes, low salt to protect your blood pressure, and exercise. And if you do those things and don't smoke, you are really probably getting rid of any factors that, even if there are genetic factors there, you'll balance them out.
Okay, so would that apply for heart disease as well as for strokes?
Yeah, absolutely, for both of them. I know that sounds awfully simplistic, you know, but it actually is the bottom line. You know, if we get now, it's there can be factors then within our own bodies that actually make those things difficult to manage. But that should be your aim, and you shouldn't become overly concerned about the genetics of a situation and be more concerned about the things you can do something about.
Yeah. Use them as a wake-up call.
But
that's easier said than done as well, I know.
Well, this is it, I know, and you know, and we all talk a good story sometimes, but
absolutely.
But, you know, if you know and you can kind of just keep it in the back of your mind that this is what you should be doing. And it's good for, you know, for parents with kids, you know, again, genetics are there. You know, we pass our genetics onto our kids, but what we can also pass on to them is really good habits and really good understanding about food and nutrition and exercise and good health. You know, so if we do all that, the good and the bad will go through.
Okay. A caller's been in touch. This is a lady who has IBS, who finds it hard to sleep at night due to pain and discomfort, and she's wondering what would you recommend. We seem to get a lot of questions about IBS. Is it more common than
It's very common.
Think.
Now, one thing, it would rarely cause too much discomfort at night for people. It tends not to be uncomfortable at night. I wonder if that lady's having problems with sleep generally, and she's just then aware of her GI symptoms as a result. IBS, we've talked about it before. It's very much, it's a functional bowel issue. It's not, there's nothing pathologically wrong. There's no structural problem with your bowel. It's difficult to manage. You manage it through trying to kind of keep your diet under control and trying to manage the other triggers for it, which are very often stress-related. Probiotics are very, very good for it, actually. So that's just something I think she might want to try. But if she's very uncomfortable, there are things you can try for it. Make sure you're not too bloated, not too, gassy and everything, because that might make her uncomfortable at night. Try and have a bowel motion before she goes to bed. But I think more importantly, maybe she just needs to relax more. She maybe needs to have a bath before she goes to bed and maybe really get into a good nighttime routine. Improve her sleep. If her sleep hygiene was very good, if she was sleeping well, her bowel would not, it shouldn't, irritable bowel should not be bad enough to wake you up from your sleep. Mm. But it may be something that if you're awake, you'll be aware of.
I was wondering if she was eating too late in the evening.
Possibly, yeah. That's one of the things too, that, you know, you should really, we all know that we should eat like larger amounts earlier in the day and lesser in the evening. But then again, you see that some of that is lifestyle as well. And if you're working late, you're, you know, how do you manage all these things, So, but certainly I think maybe look at her pattern. I don't think the IBS is the problem, really the biggest issue there. I'd say there's other issues.
Okay. So a number of different bits of advice. Mm. Hope that is of help. A very common one as well is relating to back pain. Mm. What can somebody do when pain management doesn't help, according to this listener, to talk about bulged discs and arthritis? That sounds quite painful.
Oh, yeah. Now, bulging discs, arthritis, as we get older, we all develop arthritis, degenerative change. The joints kind of become a little bit worn. And if you were to do x-rays and MRIs on everybody over a certain age, you will find degenerative changes in the backs and some bulging discs as well, possibly. And the discs are just the little shock absorbers between the bones in your spine. The significance of how much pain they cause is different for different people. And you can have episodes where you're in extreme pain for a few weeks and then it settles down. So the treatment is very variable. Some instances do need injection treatments or even surgery, but that's quite rare. Mostly, these symptoms actually settle down of their own accord, particularly if you do the non-painkiller kind of treatments. Okay. If you're using things that are more supportive, you're using things that are actually based on building the muscles around your spine up, improving your core, your abdominal core strength, so you put less pressure on your back. Physiotherapy would always be the way to go, if you ask me. Doing things like yoga and Pilates, exercises that kind of increase your core strength and also increase your flexibility. So you improve the muscles and the flexibility around your spine. Sometimes swimming is good. Sometimes it depends on where your back is hurting. If it's your neck, swimming can be difficult, but lower back, it can be very good. So all those other therapies outside of painkillers are actually what you'd recommend first. So that person is right. Like, painkillers are rarely the treatment or the answer for this. They can be an answer in the short term. If you're in extreme pain because you've, as people would say, put their back out, or they've kind of got a bit of sciatica all of a sudden, you would use an anti-inflammatory, and it can help in the short term. And we also use muscle relaxants like Valium type of treatment in the short term. And I'm talking two or three days. And that can help you get out of that intense spasm pain, but the treatments are really very much the ongoing kind of supportive exercise, improving the health of your back.
You talked about physio. From what point? I mean, this is relative, but a lot of people would have discomfort in their back and probably not too much about it, I would have thought.
Well, it depends on how much it's debilitating you. If you find that, you know, every day you have a pain in your back, or every day you're inclined to go and reach for a painkiller for your back, that's not good.
Absolutely. But even I'm going back way before that.
Stiffness in your back. Stiffness is kind of common. And I suppose ideally what you would do, no more than going to your dentist or going to your optician or whatever, to go to a physio when you have a bit of stiffness in your back is probably a very good idea, to kind of be given some advice as to how to manage it and how not to do any further damage. So how we lift things, how we stretch, how we bend. There's techniques you use, and people who do heavy lifting at work will have learned these techniques for their work, but they won't tend to do them at home, you know. So maybe getting a good kind of bit of advice from a physio, and then the massage for kind of, and then the diagnostics part of a physiotherapist as well, who'd be able to tell you, is there something more sinister going on?
I'll finish with this one and you can settle a bit, because this is a dispute at home.
Okay.
Do afternoon naps for an hour or so, are they helpful, or do they disturb sleep later on at night? I love my naps.
Oh, is this for you, not for your 3.5-year-old?
No, God, no. He's okay. Going out, though, unfortunately. I mean, I missed nap time. It was lovely.
Nap time is always a nice little treat, all right. It depends on the person, because if you have your nap and you sleep well at night, then it's fine. It means that you're just catching up and you're actually getting what you need. If you're napping because you're shattered and you have to sleep, that may be necessary too. But a lot of people, if they nap and then it interferes with how tired they are when they go to bed, that's not a good thing. Because our sleep patterns are dictated by a couple of things. They're dictated by nighttime. So darkness encourages us to sleep. Tiredness encourages us to sleep. And then melatonin is something, it's a hormone within our bodies that actually increases at nighttime. And all those three things go together, and that hopefully helps you sleep. But if you've kind of got the darkness and the melatonin, but you're not tired enough because you've had a nap, then you're not going to sleep. So take any one of those out of it, and it actually will interfere with the pattern. But different cultures would have different ways. But like, if you were living in Spain, this would be a win-win, you know. But it doesn't always work well for people. If you don't sleep well at night, the nap during the day may be interfering.
You only find that out afterwards.
Okay.
I'm a fan, as I say. Yeah. Look, it's an interesting one. There's nothing medically. There's no definitive.
No, not at all. And actually, one of the things, though, if you are exhausted, now you would be starting early in the day, and that's probably why you're so tired in the afternoon. But somebody who keeps regular hours and they have this kind of mid-afternoon slump, that's very, very common. But it can also be things related to things like thyroid dysfunction or other issues like that. So I suppose there's no harm to double-check that there isn't anything wrong.
As always, our advice is just that. If you've got concerns about your own health, please, please, please do get yourselves checked out. Dr. Maura Finn from the Ennis Family Medical Centre. We'll talk again soon. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. Back with more shortly. It's Morning Focus here on Clare FM. We will be returning to Brexit.
You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9 a.m. to 12 midday.